And we are back. Just a reminder, if you'd like to make a donation to If You've Got Ears in CKUT, you can do so at ckut.ca. You can also give us a call at 514-448-4013. Before we get back to the second part of the conversation, here is James Goddard's project Skin Tone with Butchering the Sun God from June 2017. On CQT, If You've Got Ears.
Can I ask, like, how did you, like, because you were saying when you were growing up and you started taking guitar, that everyone was just playing like Iron Maiden and stuff. Like, how did you come to experimental music? How did you get away from Iron Maiden? Or maybe not get away from Iron Maiden, but find something outside of Iron Maiden?
I think what happened was, for me, because I have, for those of you who may not be familiar with me listening, I have one hand. I was born with one hand. So part of my learning process of just being able to do conventional things on the guitar came from a lot of experimenting with unconventional ways of getting conventional sounds, I guess, because I've had to adopt a different style of playing. So I was kind of performing experimental music in my bedroom since I was a teenager, since I was like 12 years old. I didn't know what that was, though, you know what I mean? Because I was trying to sound like Iron Maiden. And then I kind of got into Sonic Youth, and then eventually Miles and Coltrane. And that kind of, I kind of started to put stuff together. And I don't know if you remember, like, the Mars Volta was really big. This is like late 2000s, like 2010s, I was still in high school. And they had elements of improv and stuff like that. I don't know. And then I can remember being into techno, and then techno being kind of connected to noise, and thinking noise was this really obnoxious white people kind of music that I wasn't allowed to participate in. And then I started getting into noise because I felt like it was dangerous because it wasn't for me. And that there was this kind of strange attraction to it. And I think around the 2 or 3 years that I was getting into noise was when I had seen you play. And that kind of like clicked, where it was like, oh, like, experimental music is for minorities and is for not necessarily rich white boys from Berlin. Not that they make bad experimental music.
It's interesting because there's definitely experimental music has a whiteness problem. Let's just put that right there out on the table and say it how it is, because there, firstly, a lot of stuff that could be experimental music isn't called experimental music or isn't conceived of and approached like experimental music because it's not made by white people. And so there's something wrong there. And I don't know how to fix it. Or my attempt to fix it is just to like insert myself into the space and be like, but I also think that on some extent, like whiteness is hurting experimental music and hurting noise, because you do have this problem where it becomes, oh, these are people who don't actually necessarily have something to say. So if you're going to be playing with the edges of like the boundaries of what sound can do, it can become a problem if you don't have something to say with that. If you're not talking about anything, and I have found in my life that I'm less and less interested in the experimental music for experimental music's sake, that or like, you know, the like harsh noise for harsh noise sake. I'm like, okay, because I definitely work hard in my music, and I think you do too, to use noise to talk about something, to use noise to represent conflict or some, you know, some of the darker aspects of humanity, and to address some of the heavier issues and darker things that happen in the world, and in my case it's specifically to Black people, and I know you use samples from the Oka crisis, and a lot of your work talks about specifically the history of the Mohawks in Kanistake, and I think that, okay, not to be arrogant or whatever, but I think that makes our music more interesting and makes it sound better somehow, even though obviously the conceptualization doesn't necessarily have to do with the sonics. I think that like having that framework also gives people a way to understand why things need to sound extreme. And sometimes just the like putting a contact mic on a buzzsaw just to like make a lot of noise, it's like at this point, or I mean, no, there's definitely creative people out there who are going to find new ways to make sound and new sounds to make, and that's true. I don't think I'm necessarily going to be one of them, and most people aren't going to be one of them. So it's like, yeah, we know what it sounds like when you put a contact mic on a buzzsaw. Like 30 people have done that already, and they've only ever played it in rooms of 30 people, but you know, they've done it. That's the reality of noise and like experimental music. So it's like, if you're going to do that, now you need to go. I feel like this is a step that some noise musicians haven't taken. So it's like, now it's time you have to take that next step, because noise music, there's conventions to it now. And so you can't just push the boundary for the sake of pushing the boundary, because it's not even pushing a boundary anymore. It there's a form and there's a box for it. So then it's like, what are you, I feel like a lot of artists need to sit down and think like, okay, I'm making these sounds are painful. What am I doing with them? Why am I making them now? Like, let's bring a bit of sophistication into our reflection on experimental music and why we're doing it, as opposed to just like, you know.
Absolutely.
Anyways, maybe I'm being too derogatory of.
No, I think that's an excellent point, and I think it's something that we've both experienced. So it's not like we're coming out of nowhere with these with these ideas. Kind of on that tip too, you, it's mentioned before that, that you've been booking shows here for almost, we could say almost a decade, right?
Put on my first show in ever in the world when I was like 15 years old. It was like a food bank fundraiser because you could like rent the hall and rent this PA from this store for cheaper if it was a like benefit concert or something. So it was like one of those classic Edmonton Hall shows. It was a punk show. And it was like, you know, $5 with a donation to the food bank or $6 if you didn't bring a donation to the food bank. And so that's how it was a fundraiser or whatever. And I think maybe like the extra money, like the $1 if you didn't bring a donation went into a tin that didn't get donated to the food bank, but got donated to Food Not Bombs. And so then I was like, yeah, 15, 16 when I did that. So I'm 34 now. I'm pretty sure I'm 34 now. So I've been booking shows for like 15, 16, 17 years, maybe. Yeah. Like 18 years or something, like most of my life at this point. I did a little small bookings in when I was in high school. And then when I lived in Sackville, we ran a house with Sackville's a really weird place, but we ran a venue out of our house. Because we lived in this, it was technically not termed a house. It was termed an estate because the property was so large, but there was like eight of us who lived in this like big old shipwright's mansion. We used to throw these, we would throw shows all the time in the house. And then I booked shows at a couple of DIY spaces in Kingston, Ontario. There was a really, really vibrant space called the Artel. And then there was a building called the Mansion that actually famously Dan Aykroyd had owned at some point. And used to have like the Blues Brothers car was like in the wall.
That's wild. There must have been some serious ghosts in that room.
Yeah, well, or maybe he busted all the ghosts and
so just on that tip real quick, closing out the interview here, I just want to ask your thoughts on maybe if you've seen any changing of the landscape, specifically in alternative music venues in the last 10 years, as far as getting seeing more visibility, Black performers, Indigenous performers, South American performers. Have you seen any shift both in attendance in the audience and on the stage? And how much do you think in the future, how much has the internet facilitated a lot of these changes that we've kind of mm-hmm. witnessed in your opinion?
That's interesting. Definitely. Like there are conversations that happen now that I like even just, I remember when I was starting out to perform as Skin Tone, just before that, I believe Casey Majika was Quit Music. And Magia, I think, was quitting music from the Toronto indie rock scene. I'm blanking on Obiju, I think was the band name, and she wrote this sort of open letter about why she was quitting music and getting out of it. And again, her project was more sort of straightforwardly indie rock and indie folk, but she was very clearly racialized, and she really openly discussed why she was leaving music was because of the way in which her racialization impacted the way people talked about her music in a way that wasn't connected to the music itself. And so there was this sort of tokenization and fetishization going on that was leading sort of music journalists astray. And so when I started playing a skin tone, I made the conscious decision to call the project Skin Tone, because I was like, this is going to be part of the conversation that I'm playing this music. Like the fact that I'm Black and the fact that I'm playing music, like there's no way I can pretend, like I will even be able to possibly pretend that it's not going to be part of the conversation or related or somehow. So I was just like, I'm going to take control of the conversation, and I'm going to set the terms of debate, and I'm going to control that insofar as I can. It's changed so much. Like it's changed so much. I think that, the fact of the matter is that there's even now, it's hard to get a grant. It's harder to get a grant if you don't incorporate people, with diverse identities into your projects. And like that's unheard. That would have been unheard. Like that was not people. White people didn't realize how white independent music in Canada was, or maybe they did. It's easy to, when you're not the only one in the room, it's easy to forget that there's no one else. Let me try and say that better. Like, I always know I'm the only Black dude at the indie rock show, or I'm not the only one, but I always knew when I was the only Black dude at the indie rock show, and you feel like you're the only Black dude at the indie rock show. Like that's what's going on. And that has a weight to it and a heft to it. If you're a white person, you don't notice that there's no Black people at the indie rock show. Cause there's no weight to that you don't feel that, it doesn't weigh on you. It doesn't present. And you don't notice if there's no, you know, indigenous people, like you don't notice that you're standing in when you're white, you don't notice that you're standing in a room full of white people. You might notice if there is a non-white person, and that's part of why that becomes weird. But I think that the people were not even ready or aware or like paying attention to those dynamics. Obviously, there have always been people, and there's always been a back and forth, and people have challenged those norms and stuff. And so I think people of color have always had long been having that conversation since something has definitely switched in the last 5 to 10 years from what I've seen, that even white people are now noticing that they're in rooms full of white people and questioning why that is, and trying to, well-intentionedly, not always with the best circumstance, but trying to figure out how to make that not be the case, and how, and I think that that's been interesting to watch that happen. Cause that wasn't even something that I thought could ever happen, that white people themselves would become concerned about the whiteness of indie rock or whatever, or independent music or DIY music and stuff. There has seemed to have been some reflection happening and people are starting to have those conversations. I don't know. I think there's still a level. I do think it's changing, but I do still feel like there's a level. I think on the side of performance, things are getting a lot better and a lot faster, because that's like way easier to control. Is just like, if you diversify your booking, like make an effort to book people of color, make an effort to book, queer people, to make an effort to book. This is a conversation that maybe we've run out of time to have, but one of the uphill battles that I'm I still don't know. I'm still not great at it, and I don't know. Is like there's no accessible venues in Montreal. There's two, the Ritz and Casa del Popolo of a sort of small size. Those are the two. Casa del Popolo. I work there, and I'm just gonna say it. It meets the letter of accessibility, like the legal code of what it means to be accessible. But when it's ram jam packed in there, I don't think that would be a comfortable space for a wheelchair user. I guess I shouldn't project, but as an able-bodied person, I find it difficult to navigate that space when it's full. So I can't imagine what it would be to if I had barriers or otherwise limits to my mobility. And so so those are the two accessible venues. And then Brasserie, we have a ramp that we can put out, but we can't leave it out all the time because the city and stuff like that. So you know, we try when we can and how we can, but that's, it's also, there's no money in that space. And so, but even though those venues are nominally accessible, I think the Ritz is more successful at being physically accessible than the other two. There's not a single accessible stage. So what is that saying? That's saying that wheelchair users can't ever be performers because no stages have ramps up onto the stage. And that's something that has been thinking about. And like, you know, I think that's the next, not to say that we're done with the race and the gender and the sexuality stuff. Like those problems are not resolved and they still persist. And you know, it's incrementally getting better. And I think, you know, definitely people who put on shows and put on events are taking more care in their curation to ensure that the rosters that they curate are diverse. And I think, so I think that work is happening, but I think that there's still something about audiences. I think that still lots of people of color, even if they see that there are people of color playing and stuff, I mean, I think that helps, are intimidated or are unsure, or as you said, like they assume that's some thing that white boys from Berlin do that's not for you. They even if you're maybe curious, you're like, oh yeah, but it's not for me. And I there still needs to be more work to, I think, because I think the audiences that I see at a lot of shows don't necessarily reflect the diversity of Montreal, and I wonder how to go about maybe making it more representative and seeing more different faces and introducing people. But I think that there's a huge problem in Montreal where we need to fix this physical, I know that a lot of spaces we've lost a few spaces during the pandemic, but the spaces that we get back, I sincerely hope that we replace the spaces we lost with physically accessible spaces, because I think that's a huge problem, and that it's really, really just bad for everyone.
Right on. I have a couple more things we could get into, but maybe we could do a part two at another time.
To set that up.
Cool. Yeah. Cool.
This has been really fantastic, James. I really, really thank you for your time and being so generous with that. And for the playlist section, I selected two pieces that I'd like to play from your catalog, if that's cool. The first being Such Loathsome Work.
Okay.
Which is one of my favorite things on the Skin Tone page. And the other one I thought that would be fitting, since we're both cast of people and we're missing live performances and also performing like specifically in the room, the cast room that is now currently a store. So all you people out there, get your Christmas shopping done, Pablo Press, support Casa, support Kiva and Mauro.
Beautiful. Beautiful shirts, beautiful cards, beautiful books, and cribbage boards.
Yeah, yeah. So I selected Butchering the Sun God, which I guess is a live performance from Casa, I guess from 2 years ago. So I just wanted to put that out there to for some of the people who are kind of missing the Skin Tone live experience or the Cast live experience.
And but I would say that just to make sure that everyone gets properly credited, Butchering the Sun God was a live performance that was recorded and recorded by CKUTier and Casa stalwart Stefan Christoph.
Oh, fantastic! Love Stefan.
He's a huge champion of all sorts of local music and political causes and just a real real asset to the city and the cultural sector in the city. And also, I guess Such Loathsome Work is actually a duet between myself and Alex Pelchat.
Cool.
Hey James, do you have a Bandcamp or any?
Yeah, I have you can, if you go to Bandcamp, it's both my Bandcamp and my SoundCloud are sort of the same. It's Skin and then the numeral 0 Tone, and if you look that up on Bandcamp, that's me, and if you look that up on SoundCloud, that's also me.
Attention McGill undergraduate students. Referendum is upon us. Exercise your right to vote on questions that matter to you and your campus experience. Vote in the fall referendum period from Monday, November 8th to Friday, November 12th. Look for your ballot in your McGill student email between November 8th to 12th. Let's rock the vote.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is If You've Got Ears, the Eliza Caution and Takeover Special Funny Drive episode. Thanks very much to Eliza for taking the time to do this with the radio station, and James for taking the time to have the conversation. We're going to run things down with a playlist put together by Eliza, some of her favorite Montreal musicians. It's an incredible playlist. Remember, ckut.ca to make a donation, or give us a call, 514-448-4013. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Senses are free. fait le pacte de rester éveillé tout au long de la nuit. Lorsqu'Étienne sera trop fatigué pour conduire, nous nous arrêterons dans un hôtel. Je les ai trouvés au bord du chemin. Deux oisiers endormis. Ils m'ont dit viens, partons. Nous t'amenons avec nous. Arrière, je peux voir son profil, son bras droit et son volant, les muscles bien découpés et la peau hâlée. Je repense à ce qu'il m'avait répondu quand je l'ai confronté à propos de son homosexualité. Il nous racontait qu'il le savait de l'enfance lorsqu'il allait au cinéma. Voir le regard des hommes. C'est beau.
Fresh breath of alternate air.